If you've ever been lucky enough to witness the huge flocks of sandhill cranes heading south in the fall, you know that their population has certainly recovered. Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau, in for Larry Mueller. Thank you for joining us on the Ideas Network. Our guests today are from the International Crane Foundation. Rich Belfus is the president and CEO, and Kim Smith is Chief Operations Officer. We'll be talking to them about the foundation's efforts to conserve cranes and ecosystems, watersheds, and the flyways that they all depend upon. What questions do you have about cranes? Are you a volunteer with the Crane Foundation? Well, we'd like to hear from you, so give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Rich, Kim, thank you so much for being here. I know it's a quick turnover from our guests. I appreciate you working with us. Rich, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do for the foundation.
You bet, Julia. Thanks. Great to be here today. So I've been with the Crane Foundation for a long time, almost 30 years.
Oh my
off
gosh.
And on. I've been in the role of president for about 8 years and spent many years running programs for the Crane Foundation. And there's actually quite a few of us that have been around for a long time. And it's just because it's great work. We're sort of passionate about the birds, and we're really passionate about the places where they live.
Sure.
And working for those places. So it's just been a wonderful journey with the Crane Foundation for a long time.
Excellent. Well, Kim, what about you?
I've been with the Crane Foundation for about 3 years.
Okay. So you're a newbie.
I am the newbie on the block. And I oversee our site operations and our North America programming.
So. Okay. And what is it about cranes what drew you to this job?
I spent over 30 years working in the zoo industry, working with zoos.
Okay.
But whooping cranes have always been a real passion for me. They're what inspired my entire career. So it's a real privilege to work here at the Crane Foundation and work with them. I oversee the reintroduction efforts as well. So it's just a lot of fun to be here. It's a great place to work.
Oh, sure. I'll bet. And Rich, why don't you tell us about the International Crane Foundation? You mentioned a little bit about what you do, but give us a little bit more of a description.
Sure. So a lot of people know us from our site, our headquarters, which is up in Baraboo, just off the interstate between Baraboo and the Dells, and that's a site where we feature the cranes of the world, and we talk a lot about where we do work around the world in Asia and Africa, across this country in Texas and all, and then here at home in Wisconsin. And you know, we think of cranes as these sort of ambassadors or gateway species to a lot of the places that we're working to save around the world. And of course, cranes don't know political borders. So
no, they don't.
We often work, in what we call transboundary projects. So we've had work bringing together a lot of countries that don't normally really work that well together. We've, working with Russia and China and a lot of the Central Asian states. We worked for many years helping bring together North and South Koreans for crane conservation, and just in many places. So they're wonderful ambassadors for that kind of work, and they're great, what we call flagships for conserving places. So where we work to save cranes, there's often sometimes hundreds of other species that use those same wetlands. And because cranes are so well known, so high profile, they give us a good focal point for really working for those places. Yeah.
And who does the funding then for all the stuff that you do? Where do you get your money from?
We're a mix of private individual donors and foundations and, what you call sort of aid agencies and so on. So we're a mix. More and more of our support comes from individual and family foundation donors. Maybe some of you listening out there.
Probably.
And then we also, work the halls of Washington, D.C. and everywhere else for various types of grants that come in through some of the bigger aid agencies. A lot of our work is a crossover between what you'd call conservation and rural development or human development. And a lot of the projects we work in really, really cross over. So it's a broad sweep of support because of that.
Okay. And you're doing some remodeling, I hear. What's going on? What are you doing? Well, either one of you want to answer that.
Maybe we better both answer that one because
yeah,
Kim has really been our chief on that and done a wonderful job.
Good.
But I'll give a quick big picture. But those who have been up in recent years know that we have some really beautifully remodeled exhibits on our site where you get open viewing of the birds in the wild, in captivity, much closer than you would ever see in the wild. And you can really see their behaviors and really learn sort of the magic of cranes, these enormous birds that are 5 to 6 feet tall. And then we have some older exhibits that actually date back to the early 80s, old sort of chain link exhibits. And we're really excited because we're basically getting rid of all those old exhibits and making all of them really experiential in the way, for some of you listening who've been, say, to our whooping crane exhibit and really sat there and absorbed the whooping crane. Some people will sit there for hours and watch the whoopers there. It's a really nice experience. And we're hoping that, you know, most or if all of our exhibits will be much more along those lines now. And then we have a new gateway center to lead people in to see that. So we're really excited about that.
Yeah. And, so Kim, fill in the details for us.
Well, we are actually going to be breaking ground in November. Ooh. So the construction is about to start. And we're very fortunate that our site will be almost completely, will be completely renovated at the end of this. We will be closed next year. So we
are the whole year?
The whole year.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So we decided to do that just to make sure we could really get this project done well and right and quickly.
Sure. Yeah.
For the birds and for our visitors. And then we'll reopen in 2020 with this brand new, beautiful site with lots of wonderful natural ways of seeing the birds. Like Rich said, all of them are going to have water features, beautiful open air viewing for many of them. It's going to be gorgeous, and I hope everyone will come back out and see us in 2020. We will have a variety of events throughout the year as well, making sure that people know what's going on, having some construction tours, those types of things. And we're also going to have a pop-up shop in downtown Baraboo with our gift shop.
Oh, that's
so
a great idea.
So we will be there and be present in downtown Baraboo. Mm-hmm. So please come see us in downtown Baraboo.
Okay. And what about the birds? I mean, what will happen while you're doing construction?
So we have an off-exhibit area called Crane City. It's our breeding area where we do a lot of our whooping crane breeding for the reintroduction and other important species breeding. And we do have room out there, so we are going to move all the birds to that area. So they'll be out there and enjoy that quiet space while construction is going on.
Unlike you guys, right? We'll be right in the middle
of
it. Well, that's very exciting news. And 2020, so if people want to go and see, they should go this year. Otherwise, next year, they might not get a chance to see anything. So, great. Now, we were talking about whooping cranes, and they made the news over the weekend, the announcement that the Operation Migration will be basically closing, if I understood that right. What can you tell us about this decision? I know it's been a long time coming and there's been some problems. Give us some background and what this means. Kim?
Well, the whooping crane program is a really important program, obviously. The birds that we're working with here in Wisconsin are part of a reintroduction effort that's a supplementary population to the wild population. So the wild population migrates between Aransaswood Buffalo in Canada down to the Corpus Christi area, Rockport, Texas, in that area. And that population is what's called the historic population. And so these reintroduction populations are supplementary to that to make sure that we have insurance, an insurance policy against disaster. So the current Wisconsin population is about 100 birds. And this year we're having one of our best years ever. We've got five chicks that are getting ready to fledge on the ground. It's the most we've ever had. There's another reintroduction population in Louisiana, and they're a little bit younger population. And they also have five chicks on the ground that have just fledged, which is really incredible
news.
It's a lot. It's really incredible. There's just, you know, reintroduction is difficult, and anytime you have to put birds back on a landscape, back into the wild, it takes a lot of work, a lot of creativity, a lot of partners. Operation Migration was a great partner for 18 years, part of the partnership, and we appreciate all the work they did. They were very creative. They did a lot of wonderful things. But the partnership, we've got wonderful new partners also right now. We're really feeling confident with that partnership, and I know we're going to continue. We've all talked already about how we're going to continue on. And we're all very confident where we're going. But again, reintroduction takes a lot of work, a lot of creativity, a lot of effort. But we really feel good about this year. And so we really feel like it's going well.
And for those who don't know, Operation Migration did the ultralight.
They did the ultralights. Yeah.
And was that also with the hand puppet, or is that a different?
No, that was us.
That was you. Okay.
Yeah, we along with some of our other partners did all of the hand rearing, the costume rearing, we call it.
Right.
And then Operation Migration would take those costume reared birds and finish them off with the ultralight flights, teaching them to migrate.
Sure.
So they were instrumental in the beginning of teaching the birds to migrate and figure out a migratory path.
Okay.
And
there's really a great story on that. You know, when we first started this project back in 2000, nobody knew what it was like, really, to reteach a migration route. There was that great movie Fly Away Home. People have a little sense, but it's really hard to bring birds back out and teach them to migrate. They had lost that knowledge in this part of the world when they were lost in the 1800s. And when we were first preparing for that project, we had to pick a point every 30 miles from Wisconsin all the way down to Florida, step by step, to land every day, you know, find a willing farmer or an airstrip or whatever. And OM, you know, had to work that through all the way down to Florida, where we'd picked out a couple of national wildlife refuges that we thought would be suitable for the birds in the winter. So we have this big plan, and they did so. They flew the birds down step by step, day after day. You know, it's like, for parents, like a nightmare trip with your kids, you know, throwing up every half hour trying to go on family vacation. You know, you're just stopping, trying to get to Florida, and you're stopping.
Right?
And We get the birds all the way down to Florida, and lo and behold, they overwinter down there. And in the spring, they fly straight back to Wisconsin to the place we originally released them in 3 days without using any of the sites we taught them, and they just buzzed straight back up here.
Just like kids. Just like kids.
So there's a lot going around in these, you know, so-called bird brains that we don't fully understand how they how they migrate, how they, you know, navigate in their heads and all. And it was fun to learn that. And it sort of gets at the key idea, though. Operation Migration was teaching the flights each year of new cohorts of birds, but after that first flight each year, the birds were on their own then forever. So birds taken down 10 years ago would be migrating on their own for those 10 years. So it was always the new cohort of birds that they would fly down. And then the birds became sort of self-sufficient in migration. And so it's a wonderful story.
Yeah, you know,
they really are becoming
is.
Wild again. So,
and that's one of the things about reintroduction is that it's an evolving process. It's a constantly evolving process, new ideas, trial and error of things that we're working on.
Right. Our guests today are from the International Crane Foundation. Rich Belfus is president and CEO, and Kim Smith is the chief operations officer. What questions do you have about conserving cranes? We'd like to hear from you. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. All our lines are open, so just get on those phones right now. Send an email to ideas@wpr.org, and we also talk about that too. So let's talk a little bit about the things that are going on with the whooping crane population. You said you had some successes this year. What are you attributing those successes to? Have anything changed? Is it the weather? What affects that?
There's a lot to that. We have 100 birds in the landscape. We've got a number of breeding pairs out there. The Nisida Wildlife Refuge this year was very open to doing some different changes in how they manage their water and their pools. So we think that helped quite a bit. We also have started a new rearing technique called parent rearing. They aren't breeding yet, so we'll see what happens there. Again, we're just experimenting. We're also doing a lot of work around the sandhill populations and researching how they do in those different areas. But as far as the success this year, we had a great wet spring, so that was really encouraging, a lot of food out there. But we had some challenges, too. We had that big April snowstorm.
I was wondering about that.
And that a lot of nests were lost out in Nisida Wildlife Refuge. So we had challenges, but we had successes. I also think it's the age of the birds. The birds are starting to mature. Some of those pairs are maturing. 18 years sounds like a long time, but in a crane's life, it's not that long. So,
how long do cranes live?
They can live upward of 30 years.
Really?
They're sexually mature of 5 to 8 years.
Okay.
So, you know, 18 years is not that long. But also in reintroduction world, it's not that long either. So as we experiment and help them in the wild, they also come into their own. So just keep watching them, keep working with them.
So what's coming up for as far as what are you looking at as far as changing or, you know, updating? Rich, what things are coming down the pike there?
Sort of across the foundation?
Well, we're
excited about a remodel. That's certainly the big news locally here and the birds coming back. But we have a lot going on around the world. And one of my favorite things to do when giving people tours here in Wisconsin is to really talk about this work and all that's going on, because there's really a lot of exciting things going on. But this year I had the opportunity to travel to Angola, and we were able to do the first survey of the eastern parts of Angola and across towards western Zambia, where we've been doing work, and extraordinary area that we're trying to get more involved in the conservation of that area for wattle crane, which is an endangered species over there, and many other birds that live there. And we have amazing programs going on in South Asia, in India, and down into Southeast Asia, working for the tallest flying bird in the world and trying to work with communities and wetlands. So that's just a lot of work going on here and there, all of it around, almost in every case, around cranes as sort of a high-profile flagship for places, around the wetlands that they depend on and the surrounding landscapes and the people that live there and share their lives with cranes in many cases. In a lot of places we work, people need their own livelihoods from those same places. So we're trying to find those kind of solutions where it's compatible with cranes and other wildlife and the people that really need to use those lands to survive.
Right. I think a lot of people will be surprised that there are cranes all over the world. Except what, Antarctica?
That's right. And none in South America, though. There were there were in the fossil record, but not
interesting.
Currently. Yeah, exactly. So they take us deep into Africa and Asia, deep into Texas, And it's funny because here in Wisconsin, here in the U.S., we have the rarest crane in the world, the whooping crane. It is the rarest of all cranes. And we have the most abundant, the sandhill.
Mm-hmm.
Both really hit lows 100 years ago and have bounced back. The sandhill is extraordinarily. We all see them everywhere now.
Yes.
And so we have the sort of two extremes mm-hmm. right now. And then a lot of the cranes are much on the rarer, more endangered end elsewhere. So that's what we're fighting for in the wild.
Yeah, and we'll talk a little bit more about that, the comeback for the sandhill crane and some other things. And of course, we want you to join us. We're talking about cranes with our guest from the International Crane Foundation, President and CEO Rich Belfus and COO Kim Smith. Do you have a question about cranes? Join them. Join us by calling 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm filling in for Larry Mueller today. Stay with us. We'll be right back after the news from NPR and WPR. Well, if you're like me, you absolutely love that sound. And if you're in Wisconsin, I'm sure you've heard it more than once. We're talking about the efforts of the International Crane Foundation to reestablish crane populations. And that was a sandhill crane that you just heard. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. Our guests from the foundation are Rich Belfus, he's the president and CEO, and Kim Smith, COO. Are you seeing more sandhill cranes in your area? Well, what questions do you have about whooping cranes? Join our conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And that was a sandhill crane. And Rich, can you address a little bit about we had a listener who called in and wanted to know the differences between a whooping crane and a sandhill. And why is one population struggling and the other one is obviously doing really, really well?
Yeah, great question. So, yeah, as I mentioned a little bit ago, there we have the most abundant crane and the sandhill crane and the rarest crane in the country, actually one of the rarest birds in the country, and the whooping crane. And they are very different birds, even though they're of the same family. A couple of things. They both hit sort of rock bottom, 100 years ago. So they both really were hit hard during the period when we were losing wetlands very rapidly, when there was a lot of unchecked hunting, a lot of effects on the population, just a lot of disturbance that they hadn't experienced for millennia as people settled this landscape coming across from Europe. But there's some really fundamental differences between the birds. Sandhills, on average, produce a couple of chicks a year. Whoopers, on average, just produce one.
Ah.
Whoopers have a little bit longer incubation period. They have a lot of their biology is a little bit more slanted towards the peopleless universe they evolved in versus sandhill cranes. Sandhill cranes have proven to be more adaptable. One of the big issues is that sandhills really switch to farmlands and to eating corn. And in addition to having a biology that sort of allows them to recover a little bit quickly, they've been more adaptable around people, and their ability to sort of thrive on farming landscapes has what's really fueled their rapid recovery in Wisconsin. As our farmers know, they're all over out here, and they're moving from there into parks and to areas all around Madison here. I see sandhills every day. And a lot of that fundamental difference, and we sort of joke, another thing is that a sandhill can hide their chicks extremely well. They're sort of brownish in color, and they can hide them, probably evolved to do that in our prairies and all. Whooping cranes, if they're spotted or under threat, make a run for it. And their response is to run for deep water and to sort of move out into deeper water. And then again, they evolved in these sort of big wetland systems that would allow for that. So that also makes them a little bit more vulnerable to predators and other problems. So there's a number of fundamental differences there between the two that can kind of fuel all of that. So
okay, great. Well, that's a lot of stuff that I didn't know, so thank you very much. Let's go right to the phones now. We've got Bill in Oregon. Hi, Bill. What's your question?
Oh, I was curious. I've seen a lot of sandhills this year, but surprisingly, I haven't seen very many family units. Just were not a lot of young. Just wondering if it was my random chance, or if I know that the cold may have had some impact in the southern part of the state, but I was curious if the heat that we experienced impacted nesting and breeding this season also.
Okay, great question, Kim.
So thank you for that question, Bill. Actually, the bigger impact is probably from the cold that we had in April. So that was right around the time when a lot of the birds, both sandhill and whooping cranes, were laying their first round of nests. And those two storms successively, unfortunately, led to a lot of nest failure. So that first round is when a lot of them were the most successful, especially for the sandhills. And so that is probably the bigger effect that you're seeing. The heat wave won't have as big of an effect because by the time that hit, those chicks should have been a lot bigger and they can still find food. So the effect you're seeing really is from those late April snowstorms.
And I wonder sometimes, too, those chicks grow so fast that it's hard to tell the difference between the adults, too. So
yeah, right now out there, when you're traveling the back roads and you see a group of three, odds are that that's a family group versus just a collection of cranes. Especially right now, they're all getting ready to think about migration, so they're all kind of collecting around. But you'll see those family groups, and odds are that you won't be able to tell from a distance that's a juvenile with its parents, but it usually is.
Sure. And we did have Judy email us and ask, where do cranes in Wisconsin migrate to?
Ah, yes. Well, so we'll sort of separate out our whoopers and sandhills again, I guess, here. So we have
sure.
about, 70 to 80,000 sandhills now moving through Wisconsin and the eastern U.S. here. And they're really wintering all over the southeast part of the country, in Georgia and Alabama. Some go down as far as Florida. In some years, when it's fairly warm, they'll even pull up in southern Illinois, Indiana, not even move that far. And that's one thing we're seeing as our winters get a little bit warmer. Cranes are traveling shorter and shorter distances for their overwintering. And for the sandhills, because they're pretty much overwintering on the waste grain of cornfields, really what they need is access to fields that aren't covered in deep snow. They're going to move down as far as they can get there. The cold, a lot of people worry about the birds in the cold, but the cold it's the food that's really pushing migration much more than sort of the cold temperatures they hear. They've got a lot of feathers, a lot of down. They do okay. For our whoopers, as I was joking before, we originally had reintroduced them, aiming for them to spend their winters down in Florida and a couple of national wildlife refuges, but they too kind of go their own way. They're staying in different places around. A number have been using Wheeler National Wildlife Refuge in Alabama. Others are in Georgia. So they too scatter around in the south. But these birds, our sandhills in the east and our whoopers, are quite separate from the birds in the Midwest further in the west, sort of central part of the country, where you have a huge migration of sandhills that's separate, goes through Nebraska and down into the southern states of the U.S. there.
Okay, great. Thanks for that question. And we also had Jim, who called in and couldn't stay on, but he said he saw recently two whooping cranes with a chick near Nikusha and wondered if it was their chick or of cranes. Do cranes adopt other chicks?
So that was definitely their chick. That's one of our known pairs, and
okay.
We're really proud of that pair right now. They're doing a great job out there, so it's really fun that he saw them. If you see them out there with a chick, odds are it's theirs, but they will adopt, but not when they currently have a chick.
Sure.
So we do a technique called fostering. So when a pair loses in the wild a chick, when we are rearing chicks for release, we do go out there and try to foster that chick to that pair. They often will take them and then teach them the migratory path.
Oh, so it's pretty successful. Great, yeah. Great. Well, let's go back to the phones. We've got Tana on from Ellison Bay. Hi, Tana.
Hi, good morning, or good afternoon now.
Yep, good afternoon.
Thank you. I live up in northern Door County, up in Ellison Bay, Wisconsin, and we have a great group of sandhill cranes here that comes back to our farm every year. But I had heard last year that, and I don't know if this is true or not, but that there is now a hunting season for sandhill cranes. And if so, what went into that decision, and how do you think that will affect our population of cranes here?
Well, thanks for the question, Tana. Go ahead, Rich.
You bet. So there currently is not a hunting season for sandhill cranes in Wisconsin. So it has been discussed. It's been proposed in past years, but never moved very far. And so there currently is no hunting season in Wisconsin. There are hunting seasons either fully in place or developing in the southeast for this same migratory flock in Kentucky and Tennessee. So hunting is out there, not in other states. And in the West, a lot of people don't know, but sandhills are fairly heavily hunted out west, Texas, Oklahoma, the Dakotas and Montana, and up into the provinces of Canada out there, Manitoba and Saskatchewan. So there is a fairly substantial hunt out in the West. We don't know if another hunt will be proposed here in Wisconsin. You know, our position has been that there's a lot of reasons why we should be very concerned about that hunt. We're worried about mistaken identity with whooping cranes, which has proven to be a big issue. We're concerned that this is a breeding ground, and the cranes have really been radiating out to places like Door County. And we feel that's in large part because the population has been fairly undisturbed and able to spread out over Wisconsin and into the northeast part of the country over time. So it's a lot of their recovery has come by their ability to kind of spread out in the landscape. So we continue to really focus on working with farmers and making sure that the birds aren't causing damage to farmers to help solve any problem with crop depredation. So the farmers who really were responsible for the crane's recovery will continue to be very supportive of that. And we feel that's sort of the best way forward.
Now, if there's a farmer out there, somebody who is actually having problems with the sandhill, can they contact you for help?
Absolutely. You know, we were very involved in developing a deterrent, which is basically a non-toxic chemical that you apply to corn and really tastes bad to cranes. And so the idea is that if they eat crane with this chemical, they won't just fly off to another farm that doesn't have a chemical. They'll just switch to the other foods that they eat on those farms, which is grubs and waste grain and insects and other stuff. So we're trying to keep them on the farms, but eating pests and other stuff and not new shoots of corn, which is what we're trying to avoid. So there's a great chemical that's now marketed called Avapel. It also repels turkeys and blackbirds and other predators of new crops and seeds. And the really good news is that it's taken quite a while, but the Avapel was just formally registered with the EPA. It's a long process to get there, which should mean the price will now come down further and it'll be even more widely available for farmers. And so we do a lot of work to try and raise awareness about its availability as a really good alternative. And again, it keeps the cranes on the farm, but in a beneficial role rather than any conflict with farm production.
So. Oh, that's wonderful. Mm. Yeah. Next up, we have who do we have? Cindy in Lake Mills. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. I'm calling. We've got a family that has been on our farm for about 6 years. That they have two babies, and but then all of a sudden there's only one that always lives. Is it that they don't I guess I don't understand why that second baby never makes it.
Okay. All right, thanks for the question, Cindy. Kim, why don't you go ahead and address that?
So typically in many bird species, you know, you have these multiple chicks that hatch, and it's kind of a hedge for that family to make sure they at least get something off the ground, right? So typically with cranes, you get the two chicks that hatch, and they are hoping that both will survive, and the parents work very hard to make sure both survive. But in the end, usually one does not, and that just is a matter of, it's usually the smaller chick, it's usually the one that hatched second, a little bit younger. But also, it's just the nature of being out there in the wild and out there foraging. So if a predator happens to come, they'd only take one chick and not both, hopefully. But it is a hedge against losing both chicks. That it's a strategy that a lot of birds, a lot of animals employ. So that's why you see it. You do see some pairs pull off two chicks, and those are kind of those super pairs out there in the environment that are terrific pairs, terrific parents, and have a good strategy and a good environment to raise their chicks.
Okay, great. Thanks for that question. Let's go to Sylvia in Appleton.
Hi. I have a comment before a question, and I wanted to thank these people and everybody else that's associated with the Crane Foundation. I used to do the crane count years ago, and I do mean years ago because I was fortunate enough to even meet Ron Sowie and see nice. Tex. But my question is, I've read the leg bands off of several cranes, the colors. Is there some place I can go to get more information on those cranes?
Yeah, there is. If you we have a big database, so if you report into our staff, we can give contact information for staff. They can tell you location and information about those birds. They often do that for different birds out in the wild, and so it's a nice opportunity. We get a lot of reports in on whooping crane sightings. People are always excited to see something new on the landscape, and we track many of those birds. So we're able to confirm some of those sightings and provide some more information about when the birds were released to the wild and so on. So,
now, yeah. She's talking about banding? Is there a number or something?
They have leg bands.
Leg bands.
The whooping cranes that are released into the wild are banded. So they'll have a leg band. It's a color combination and a number that someone, if you can get close enough or have good binoculars, you can pick off. And then occasionally you'll see sandhills that are banded out in the wild, too. Okay. We had a big project banding birds a little bit east of our center in Baraboo. And so there's quite a few birds in that area that we banded to study the sort of long-term ecology and survival of sandhill cranes as well.
Okay. Our guests today are from the International Crane Foundation. Rich Belfis is president and CEO, and Kim Smith is the chief operations officer. What questions do you have about conserving cranes? We'd like to hear from you. We have open lines. Their number is 1-800-642-1234. And of course, you can always send us an email, and that's ideas@wpr.org. I know we've had people call in the past that wasn't sure if they saw a whooping crane or if they saw a sandhill crane. What are some of the characteristics to look for when you're trying to identify them out in the field?
It's funny. It's when you sort of look at drawings of the birds, you might think, oh, it's just a brown one and a white one. You know,
yeah,
sort of, how can I tell them apart?
It's not that simple. Yeah. It never is.
But when they're together, whooping cranes are substantially bigger than sandhills. So if you ever see them together, and often people are more and more seeing them in mixed flocks, whooping cranes really stick out. So they're quite a bit bigger. I remember the first time I saw a whooping crane in the wild was on the Platte River in Nebraska, where you get this phenomenal concentration of birds every year migrating through hundreds of thousands. And I saw one whooping crane among, you know, these thousands of sandhills. And I thought, how can you ever see a whooping crane? Well, they stood right out there, you know, sort of a whole neck and head length above. So they are easy. But sometimes, rarely, you get an albino form of a sandhill that'll look really white, or a chick in the right light that'll look really white. But if they're with other sandhills and they're about the same size, it's probably a sandhill in bad light. The whoopers really stick out.
They really stand out.
And more and more people are seeing pairs of whoopers around in the landscape here. They'll always be banned, as we had a caller about the leg band a minute ago. Here in Wisconsin, anyway, the birds that are being released into the wild are banded. So you'd see a leg band on them. Sometimes even a little radio band where we're tracking them, satellite band. So yeah, but they're if you ever get to see one and you have some familiarity with sandhills, which are more and around, the whoopers really do stick out there. They're an enormous bird. They are the tallest bird in North America and one of the tallest birds that flies in the world. So
amazing. Six feet or so? Or?
Yeah, not quite. Over 5.5, but they're very tall. They look you, if you come to the Crane Foundation and you look them eye to eye, it's pretty unforgettable.
intimidating, maybe?
Yeah.
You know, we were talking earlier about some of the work that the foundation does internationally, but how many types of cranes are there?
Yeah, so there's 15 species of cranes worldwide, and we work a lot with 4 endangered cranes in Africa and another 5 endangered cranes in Asia. And then the whooping crane is a big focus for us. Actually, six endangered cranes in Asia, and then our whooping cranes here in North America. And so a lot of our work is in areas that are very poor or very rapidly developing. It's sort of the two extremes. So in East Asia, we have an office in Beijing, China, and we work a lot with our colleagues in China and in Korea and around in the region, in Russia, actually, and Mongolia. And in part of that region is really rapidly developing. So you're seeing the kind of habitat loss that happened in this country 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we have some perspective on that, and we look for solutions to that. And then in other parts of Asia, you have really deep poverty, and we're working with farmers and people on landscapes that have cranes that really are eking by a living and trying to address issues that relate to that. And then Africa mostly, and we work in a lot of countries in Africa, we are working around with communities that share lands with cranes. And Africa's been, and many countries in Africa have been a big area of concern because crane populations have been going down rapidly. Unlike our story of recovery here, actually both for the whoopers and the sandhills, they're really coming back now. And it's exciting to see that, whether they're rare or abundant. But a number of the birds have been going down in Africa. Problems with populations growing and expanding and using resources more intensively. So we've really had to work there with a lot of local partners to find solutions, lasting solutions in that kind of setting, often doing a lot of work with water, invasive species, farming conversion of wetlands, trying to find alternative livelihoods for people that that need to get a living but might have alternatives that aren't right in the wetlands and might still be compatible with the birds that are there. So cranes take us all over. As I said, they're sort of ambassadors on the one hand and really great flagships for individual places that are very important for people and for wildlife.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Yeah, lots of stuff to do.
No shortage.
Well, we do have some more phone calls, so let's go back. We've got Doug in Baraboo up next. Hi, Doug.
Hey, yeah, how you guys doing? Yeah, wonderful to speak to you, and Crane Foundation is doing wonderful work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, hey, I'm wondering, you're talking about banding the cranes. I was also wondering if you band them with tracking mechanisms. I've seen some trucks every now and then that have radio receivers on it, so I was wondering what, how you track them radio-wise and what telemetry you get off them if you do that.
Go ahead, Kim.
So our staff, you have seen our staff out there. You usually see the gray van with the big tracking antenna on top. So they are out and about tracking. Mainly that's whooping cranes that are tracking. So they are tracking the chicks that we've banded in past years and chicks we are getting ready to release. So they are using radio telemetry for that. But we also do banding where we use satellite telemetry as well. So it depends on which birds we've done that with. So we can use two different types of methods to track them. When you see the van out there, that's more for local tracking of where they are. If we want to locate an individual, the cellular type tracking is, you know, as they're migrating, of knowing approximately where they are in the United States or within their eastern migratory pathway. But if we ever need to find a bird, like it's out, you know, out in Indiana or something, we can use that radio tracking as well to find a bird if it's out there. And sometimes we find when there's a shooting victim, that's how we find them as well.
Okay, great. Thanks for that question, Doug. And just a couple follow-up questions. We just have a few minutes left. Having to do with Florida, one person wanted to know where in Florida that the birds go. And also, when they get down to Florida, they don't have babies there, do they? Just up here, is that correct? So they just have one set?
Sure. So whooping cranes, if we're talking about whooping cranes or sandhill cranes.
Probably sandhills, I would imagine.
Okay, that's more. So we have sandhill cranes that migrate from here down to Florida. As I mentioned, mm-hmm. they sort of scatter all over the southeast, but some go all the way to Florida. And then there's actually a group of sandhills, a subspecies called the Florida sandhill crane that actually stays in Florida year-round and breeds.
Okay.
So depending on which sandhills you're looking at, they may actually be raising chicks in down in Florida, kind of central parts and southern parts of Florida. So you do have both down there. So some of them are our birds and some are their birds.
Some are
down there.
So. The smart ones live down there. I'm just kidding. Yeah. Okay. Well, we thank you guys so much for coming and we really appreciate it. We've been talking with Rich Belfus and Kim Smith from the International Crane Foundation. Find out more about the organization at their website, savingcranes.org. Thanks to Brianne Chasseau for on-air production and to Sarah Hopeful for technical direction. Tomorrow at this time, Larry will be back with our regular bird expert, Bill Volkert, to talk about fall migration and other birding news. Lots of birds going on here. That starts at 11 o'clock. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm filling in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Hope you can enjoy the rest of your day. Stay with us. There's a lot more to come.